Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Burn for Now by Bob Howard, narrated by Graham Halstead. 1. Prologue. The Jasper silo had never housed a nuclear missile, but it did hold a wealth of information about the missile fields that were part of the United States' triad of nuclear weapons. Specifically, there was information about the decommissioned silos that had been converted to strategic storage facilities located near the active silos. Their mission was to provide support for the Air Force personnel who would be left with no way to survive if they ever had to launch their weapons. There was a network of hardened tunnels that ran between them, and over time, the tunnels were upgraded to allow for easy access to the missile silos. Most of the documentation on the Jasper silo computers was highly classified, but once again, Gentry Campbell proved to be every bit as good at hacking computer systems as she was at everything else related to science. She uncovered one particular file that outlined how the Air Force would evacuate personnel in stages to living quarters inside the storage silos. It was an incredibly complex operation that included the movement of personnel to different locations around the country in a very short amount of time. If it was possible to keep the bombers in the air, they had to be able to return for new payloads, and that meant having them land near their resupply depots. The Department of Defense had to decide which silos would remain active, which would be repurposed as storage facilities or living quarters, which would become tourist attractions, and which would be sold to private investors. There was no lack of interest from the private sector, with prospective buyers lining up at the doors of their congressmen and senators. The Department of the Interior wanted to be first to choose which silos were the best ones for tourism, and private contractors were sending bids to anyone who even remotely stood a chance of obtaining the silos. The prospects for developing the system were met with great enthusiasm. The largest vendors of non-perishable supplies increased production as if the United States was at war, and shipments arrived at Warren Air Force Base in Wyoming before the silos were even renovated. But that only meant there would be no delay once the silos were ready to be stocked. The same was true for the major suppliers of weapons. Shipments of small arms and ammunition were stockpiled by the manufacturers and ready to distribute as soon as they were given a destination. The General Accounting Office would make the final decisions, and they were pressured to find a way to make everyone happy. That was how they wound up building silos around the country. Since there weren't enough missile silos for everyone, locations were selected that were supposed to ensure the continuity of civilian populations as well as military and government agencies. They already knew about the shelters that belonged to Titus Rush and his survivalist group, and if they wanted to keep hidden the fact that they'd been funding those shelters, they had to meet everyone else's demands. It was a massive undertaking that led to the creation of a network that collapsed under its own weight because it was designed to provide continuity under different circumstances. No one considered the possibility of a zombie apocalypse. As a result, people didn't arrive at the silos to activate them. In some instances, it wasn't physically possible to navigate through the traffic jams and roadblocks to reach the silos, but in many instances, the people who were assigned the responsibility of activating the shelters were among the first to be infected. Occupants who actually reached their assigned shelters were mixed with the masses of evacuees who all had the same problem. Nowhere else to go. But for some unexplainable reason, people have always thought it's best to climb something. Whether it was a tree, a building, or a mountain, people tried to get to higher ground. Wyoming had plenty of higher ground for people to find, but below ground, the infection raged. 2. Wyoming. East of Warren Air Force Base, the beginning. The National Park Service tour schedule in the brochure indicated that the Evans family had arrived on time and wouldn't be forced to wait until the next group was allowed to begin. The wide open country surrounding the decommissioned Minuteman missile silo was breathtaking, But after driving for a few hours with two restless children in the back seat, Frank and Shannon were questioning their own decision to visit the Cold War Museum. By the time they reached the parking lot inside the silver chain-link fence, the scenery was less breathtaking and a little more monotonous. Shannon had become irritated with her husband when he turned the radio back on after she turned it off. When she reached for the power button a second time, he snapped at her angrily. "I was listening to that," he said in an abrupt tone.
"And I'm tired of the same sensationalism on every news network. The media goes after violent stories like dogs after bones. Besides, the kids don't need to hear that garbage."
"I wouldn't call an outbreak of cannibalism garbage."
"And I wouldn't call it news for children to hear."
Frank hated the way his wife always put a comma at the ends of his sentences, as if she was finishing them for him. She even did it to him when he wasn't done yet, but this time it was also keeping him from hearing what they were saying on the news. The parking lot wasn't crowded, and Frank slid the SUV into a space across from a charter bus. He kept it to himself, but he hoped the large group still packed inside behind the tinted windows of the bus wouldn't be ahead of them. He could see someone standing just inside the windshield with a microphone in front of his face. He was undoubtedly giving instructions to the people in their seats, and that would give the Evans family a chance to get ahead of them. "Let's hurry, everyone. We don't want to be in the ticket line behind them," he said.
"That's a charter group. They won't need tickets."
Frank didn't know why that irritated him even more, but he felt like the fight they'd been having was just a warm-up for the big event. "All right," he said with enough edge in his voice to get accused of having a tone. "Let's hurry and get inside before the charter group." Everything about the day was starting to feel like a bad decision. Even stepping from the car onto the rough gravel parking lot was annoying. It was hotter than he would have preferred, and the chunks of gravel felt like they were trying to force their sharp edges through the soles of his shoes. He reached for his sunglasses, but they weren't in his shirt pocket where he thought he'd put them. "Great," he muttered.
"What now?"
"Nothing. Let's just get inside out of this heat." Frank pulled open the back door of the car and leaned inside to give Rick a hand, but his son ignored the offer of help and brushed past him. He was 10 years old, and Frank recognized the attitude. Greg was 11, and Rick was always the victim of some of his mischief. That and the fight in the front seat of the car were enough for the attitude to surface. Greg got out of the passenger side of the car and stayed close to his mother. That was Frank's clue that Greg had been victimizing his younger brother while the parents were distracted. Rick was halfway to the ranch-style house before Frank even got the doors locked on the car. Shannon and Greg were slightly ahead of him, but both were walking slower. Frank was sure it was because she wanted to aggravate him, but if they had been walking faster, he wouldn't have heard what Greg asked her.
"Mom, aren't cannibals people who eat people?"
Instead of answering him, Shannon gave Frank a withering stare. In his mind, he heard someone ring the bell and yell, "Round one!"
"Don't pay any attention to what you heard on the radio," she said loud enough for her husband to hear.
Despite the exposed nerves, the cool air conditioning that hit them when they stepped inside the ranch house was an instant remedy. "Ah, that feels nice," said Frank. There was still a lingering cold shoulder from Shannon, but the Park Service employee was all smiles at the new arrivals, and they couldn't get away with the hard feelings that had risen to the surface during the tedious drive. He went right into his monologue directed at the Evans family and six other tourists that had assembled ahead of them. Frank's mind wandered back to reports on the radio that had been on every channel. Right from the start, he had been jolted. It wasn't only the fact that police departments in several cities had been responding to calls involving assaults. That happened all the time. These assaults all had a common theme. The calls were made to 911, the police responded, and the perpetrators were eating their victims.
Maybe he would have handled it better if the reporters hadn't sounded so shaken up. Shannon had immediately launched into a long rebuttal of the reports, and his suggestion that they should cancel their vacation was met with stern denial. "Don't you remember? This happened a few years ago when that zombie movie came out. Everyone was going on about viruses causing the dead to come back to life, and there were news reports about a homeless guy eating someone behind a dumpster in Miami. The police had to shoot him because he wouldn't stop and even attacked them. Then everyone went nuts when the same thing happened in Los Angeles, like they were somehow connected. Come on, homeless people, drugs, and mental illness, those things don't happen on both coasts." The whole time Shannon had carried on as if Frank was somehow responsible for what they were hearing on the radio, and he was watching the reaction in the back seat of the car. He thought to himself that the radio news wasn't half as bad as what she was saying. Rick still slumped a bit as the Park Service guide finished his opening comments, and Frank realized he needed to remember why they were on this particular vacation to start with. Rick had asked if they could take the tour because he'd been learning the history of the missile sites in school, and it was supposed to be an opportunity for them to patch up a few loose shingles in their relationship as a family. He and Shannon had been arguing in front of the boys just a little too often. Now it was turning into another situation where they might all be silent in the car when they drove home. Frank decided it was time to fix things before they were too broken. A few inches closer to Shannon got him close enough so he could whisper, "I'm sorry. I'm being a jerk." He could see the apology caught her off guard, but it was the right thing to do. She had obviously wanted to make things right, too, because the relief on her face was obvious. She also melted into him the way she used to do before the kids were born. When Rick glanced back in their direction, he beamed when he saw her leaning against his father with her head resting on his shoulder. Greg seemed indifferent to it, but that wasn't strange for him. The guide motioned for everyone to follow him, and the group moved together through the quarters that had housed military personnel who waited around the clock for a nuclear war to start. He explained how they had lived, where they ate and slept, and what they did to pass the time. He made jokes about what they watched on TV, and the jokes were a little forced from being told too many times. After taking more than a half hour to show off a house that was a lot like a fire station with its long shifts, it was time to descend into the depths below the house. They were finally going to see one of the monsters that would have heralded the end of the world if it had ever been set loose from its prison. The guide even changed his tone of voice to reflect the seriousness of what they were about to see. He led them to the elevator that would take them down. Frank kept his left arm around Shannon's waist, and the fight during their drive was put behind them, even if it wasn't completely forgotten. Shannon had seen the reaction on Rick's face, and she was all for putting her anger aside. It was almost as if descending over 100 feet into the earth was a way of leaving the real world behind. The real world and the unbelievable reports on the radio. There were the usual warnings from the guide about everyone keeping their fingers away from the folding elevator door, not touching anything that was inside the chained-off display areas, and not stepping outside the yellow, marked paths. The elevator came to a stop, and the tour group followed the guide down a narrow tunnel that sloped under their feet. Reese Vinson had been raised on a ranch in Montana, and even though he missed his home state, he couldn't pass on the opportunity to buy one of the parcels of land a few miles south of the missile field. He had learned of the government sale through military friends in Montana. They were scaling back the missile deterrent force, and as the silos were decommissioned, the surrounding land was either sold or taken under the control of the Park Service. He didn't plan to do much with the property, but he could at least live there until he knew what he planned to do with the rest of his life. He'd only lived on the property for a year when he got an offer he couldn't refuse. A big utility company offered him a large sum of money to build a wind farm on his land, and the best part was that he could still live there. The wind turbines were built without a hitch, and he was left with a bank account flush with cash. If he had stayed in his remote home and not given in to boredom, maybe he would have survived the beginning of the infection. But Vegas was the perfect playground for a tall, rich young man. He decided he could afford to lose a little money, as long as he had a good time doing it. After a week into a winning spree, Reese was way out ahead and didn't know if he would ever get enough of his good luck. He even considered buying a suite near the center of the gambling strip and making it a more permanent living situation. He considered it until the night when a disheveled man with blood on his shirt had literally fallen over him on the crowded strip. Reese had simply decided to sit on a low brick wall and enjoy the evening. People passed by in groups, couples, or alone, and he had winked at a few of the ladies. His country accent and boyish looks earned him some smiles in return. Then the man came through the tide of people. Reese saw him approaching, and he didn't appear to be well. A strand of saliva dangled from the man's chin, and all Reese could figure was that the man was going to throw up on him. As the man fell toward him, he saw the pretty ladies and the groups get out of the way and scurry past the inevitable scene. Reese let himself fall to the left, and the momentum of the stranger carried him to the spot where Reese had been. The man's knees hit the low wall, and he did an impressive flip into the landscaping. He was a bit concerned for the man, and Reese turned with an appeal to the crowd of people who avoided his eyes and hurried past. His concern lasted for as long as it took for him to notice the tear in his pants across his right thigh. Reese put his fingertips to the tear and then studied them, wondering when in the world he could have gotten cut. Reese turned his legs toward the bright lights that washed the casino behind him so he could get a better look at the cut, and he saw that there was a flap of skin missing. It burned, and even though he still couldn't imagine how it happened, he knew he needed to get it treated. A cab dropped him off at a dock-in-a-box place that already had a line out the door, and before the cab driver could pull away, he slapped his hand against the window to get him to stop. "I've changed my mind. Just take me to a drugstore, but wait outside for me." "Why? So you can go out the back door, cowboy? This ain't my first rodeo, so I need a deposit to wait." Reese slapped a wad of bills in the driver's hand without counting it. "Is that enough?" The driver eyed the 5 $100 bills and nodded. "Where to after the drugstore, cowboy?" "The airport," said Reese. The drugstore turned out to be a superstore of some kind, and Reese was able to buy a pair of jeans to replace his torn slacks. It occurred to him that TSA would be a bit leery of someone boarding a plane with no luggage while wearing torn pants and sporting a fresh bandage on their leg. He bought a small suitcase and a variety of items to put inside it. He had already decided that the hotel could keep his abandoned luggage. He was leaving with more than enough money to cover it. Reese thought the airport was busier than it had been when he arrived, and even first class had been completely filled on the last available flight of the night. He had to settle for a seat near the back of the plane, squeezed in between two people who didn't care about armrest rules. Fortunately, the pilot announced that the flight wasn't a long one. The airport at Cheyenne, Wyoming, is only 2 miles from Warren Air Force Base, and Reese had left his car there in a long-term parking garage. When the plane landed, he thought the extra sweat and heat that poured out of his body was a result of the claustrophobic airplane ride, and he was sure he would feel better once he got away from the airport. He walked past the people hanging around the luggage carousel and went straight out the door. Even though the Air Force Base and airport were only a few miles from his ranch, it was too far for him to finish the drive. He made it to the familiar wind farm, but the huge turbines spinning at the tops of their towers made him nauseous. Reese pulled over to the shoulder of the road and leaned his head forward to rest it on the steering wheel. He squeezed his eyes shut and fought against the urge to let the contents of his stomach come out. He won the battle for almost 5 minutes before he slung open the door and doubled over. The cramps were so bad that he clutched his stomach and lost his grip on the steering wheel. Instead of vomiting, he rolled head first from the car. His feet got caught in the steering wheel, but not in time to stop his head from making solid contact with the road. Just before slamming into the pavement, Reese Vinson thought of the man who fell over him. It had happened so fast, but he remembered the way the long strand of saliva trailed behind the man as he passed by. It was tinted red, just like the strand of saliva trailing from his own mouth now. It reached the pavement 2 seconds before his head. On behalf of Wild West Charters, I want to thank you for choosing our bus service. I hope you enjoy the ride and the other amenities. The other amenities that the driver didn't list in detail were the box lunches and warm sodas. The company brochure described something a whole lot more exotic than the sandwich meals, and the warm sodas were supposed to be refreshing beverages that would leave them satisfied. The satisfaction everyone felt was when they finally got their turn inside the tiny bathroom at the back of the bus. There was nothing like a warm soda on a 2-hour bus ride. It was, as the man said, satisfying. 40 people waited anxiously for the man to finish his speech and open the doors, and they didn't know he was stalling because they were ahead of schedule. It didn't help when people saw the Evans family park in front of them and go right in. A middle-aged woman in the front seat stood up and elbowed her way past the driver while he was in mid-sentence. She stepped down to the door without paying him the least bit of attention, and her bold move had the desired effect. The other passengers acted as if someone had told them to get up. Within seconds, the aisle was full, all the way to the back of the bus, and 2 more people had pushed past him to get in line behind the woman. He was forced back into his driver's seat. "Whatever," he muttered. Roger Larson hit the switch that made the pneumatic door open, and everyone moved forward as if they were tied together with rope. The only delay was when one of the older passengers was too slow to get out of her seat. She complained to the man who was blocking the aisle for her that she didn't want to see the big missiles, and for a moment it seemed like half the busload was going to be kept inside with her. The man, who turned out to be her son, coaxed her out with some vague promises about how she would enjoy the tour, and the line moved again. The heat outside the bus didn't help the sour moods, and a few of the tourists said they wanted to get back on the bus where the air conditioning was. They formed a new line and waited impatiently for people to get off the bus. 3 National Park Service guides stood in a row watching the ebb and flow of people by the bus, and when a few of them made an attempt to go inside the ranch house, the guides spread further apart and herded them back together in the parking lot. "If I can have your attention, please." One of the guides held his hand high in the air. He had seen this behavior before and had expected it when he saw the charter bus pull into the parking lot. He had lobbied for a bigger souvenir gift shop to keep people busy while waiting for their turn to begin the tour, but so far his efforts hadn't gotten the results he wanted. He also knew what reaction to expect from his first announcement. "Please divide yourselves into 4 groups of 10 people. The first group will begin their tour in about 30 minutes, and the other 3 groups will follow in 15-minute intervals."
"You mean the last group won't even go inside for over an hour? What are we supposed to do until then?"
It was the woman who'd elbowed her way past the driver, who somehow appointed herself as a spokesperson. She had also wandered toward the rear of the bus and was now separated from the first 10 people toward the front. She was trying her elbow tactic on the people in front of her, but not making the same progress she had with the driver.
"The first group can go inside the gift shop until their tour begins, and then the second group can shop for souvenirs as soon as the first group begins their tour."
The tour guide sometimes joked about how the Cold War didn't have as much tension as the groups that arrived in charter buses. They all preferred the small family tours like the one that was going on at present.
There was a fair amount of discontent in the parking lot, and it got even more heated when the bus driver closed the door as soon as the last passenger stepped out of the bus. The people who had lined up to get back on the bus found themselves facing the glass door, and Roger was pretending there was something more interesting to see out his side window. The man at the head of the line slapped his flat palm against the glass and yelled for Roger to open the door. What he couldn't see was that the driver actually did spot something interesting on his side of the bus. Just past the rolling gate at the entrance to the parking lot, a man staggered down the middle of the road. At first, he appeared to Roger to be strolling because he was taking his time, but then it became obvious that the man was having difficulty walking. He walked as if his feet weighed far too much for his legs to lift them, so he shuffled enough to cause a small dust cloud to trail behind him. Out the windshield of the bus, Roger saw one of the tour guides usher 10 people into the building. He absently calculated that the first group of shoppers would likely be starting their tour by the time the slow walker made it from the gate to the bus. That meant 10 people would be in the gift shop, and 20 would still be outside. He opened the door of the bus with the thought that he would rather only have 10 of his customers outside when the man arrived.
"It's about time," grumbled the first man who came back inside.
He went back to his seat and found what was left of his warm soda.
"Better than nothing," he said to no one in particular.
As soon as everyone in line was back on the bus, Roger closed the door again. Someone behind him asked another tourist what that man was doing, and gradually they all watched as the man got steadily closer.
"He looks like he's been in a wreck or something," said one of the women. "Shouldn't we go help him?"
Roger didn't think he should open the door, and most of the group that had gotten back on the bus were in agreement. There was a consensus that the National Park Service people were the ones responsible for helping him. The remaining pair of female tour guides who waited outside with groups 2 and 3 were a little apprehensive about the man. He was dirty, and there were big stains on his shirt that matched the color of his matted hair. One arm swung from side to side as he walked, and the other arm was tucked to his stomach as if he was unable to straighten it. His face could have been a big, ripe tomato. The younger of the two Park Service employees leaned toward the other and asked,
"What's his story? Does he look okay to you?"
The older woman, Marge Temple, had never seen anyone walk through the front gate into the enclosed area, let alone stagger in. She was uncomfortable about his arrival long before the younger woman asked for her opinion, and was already thinking it would be a good idea to contact their supervisor.
"I'm getting Mike on the phone. I don't know why we can't carry guns. Everyone else in this state has one."
She disappeared inside, and most likely didn't even hear the younger woman ask her to hurry. It wouldn't have mattered anyway, because Mike's voicemail told her he was unavailable at the moment. She thought about trying to reach him with their shortwave radio, but she got a glimpse of the parking lot from the office and knew Mike wasn't going to be able to do anything for them. She dialed 911 and listened to the ringtone as she stared out the window. The younger woman, Lisa Wanamaker, was only 20 years old, and she'd gotten the minimum wage job as an intern. She'd only been at the decommissioned silo for a month, and was told the biggest problem she might ever encounter was a customer who thought it would be no big deal if they stole one of the display items. The number one item people tried to steal was one of the magazines the military personnel had read to pass the time. Old copies of Reader's Digest and Life magazine from the 60s were scattered around the recreation room on the other side of the restricted areas, and tourists acted like Park Service personnel had bad peripheral vision or something. They probably made more in fines from the citations they wrote than they did from tour fees. Lisa mustered up the courage to step toward the man rather than wait for him to reach them. As she closed the gap between them, she realized this was no ordinary customer. The man was injured far worse than she had thought, and there were insects clinging to the side of his head, where it looked like his hair had been painted with a wide brush.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?